Hey, Cliff Goldstein here again, and I want to begin by talking about one of the more interesting and enigmatic figures in 20th century thought. This guy published one short book in his life, and yet went on to become one of the most influential philosophers of the past century, a man whose influence continues today. Now, his name is Ludwig Wittgenstein, and I don't imagine it's a household name, to be sure, and many of those who've read him probably, or have heard of the name, probably haven't read him, and many of those who have read him have probably, who have taken the time to read him, have probably, been struggling over his writings the same way I have over the years, trying to figure out what he was saying. In fact, there's been a whole cottage industry has grown up around Wittgenstein and his teachings. Just what was the guy saying? And it's funny, books have been written about trying to say, you know, explain what he said, and other people wrote books arguing against those books. And I think it's kind of funny. The fact that people are arguing over what he says in a very interesting way kind of proves what he was saying, because Wittgenstein was a philosopher of language, and he spent a great deal of his time trying to show the limits of language and the limits of what our words mean. So the fact that people are still arguing over what he's saying sort of vindicates what he's saying. But more important, I want to talk about him because I believe that there's some implications in his writings that can get to the heart of the question regarding the existence of God, though I sincerely doubt that that's what he was aiming for. On the other hand, Wittgenstein was smart enough that I think he might have seen those implications. But anyway, I want to talk to you a little bit about Wittgenstein. He was an Austrian who lived in Europe during the time of the Third Reich. Now, this sort of problematic, because number one, he was a Jew. Number two, he was a homosexual. Number three, he was an intellectual. And number four, he was into left-wing politics. So it was really no wonder that Wittgenstein spent a fair amount of time away from the continent. In fact, he spent much of his time living in England. Now, I just want to give you a few little facts about his life that we get into what I really want to say. He was born in Vienna in 1889, and he came from a fabulously wealthy family. I mean, you see pictures of his houses. They looked like palaces. And both his father's parents were Jewish, and his mother's father was Jewish. And his family, they converted to Catholicism. You don't get the impression that they were very religious at all. Very talented family. In fact, Wittgenstein had a bunch of brothers and sisters, and he had four brothers, and three of the brothers ultimately committed suicide. Talented, but very tormented. And Wittgenstein, during his life, was so tormented and depressed at times that many of his friends feared he was going to do the same thing. Now, it's interesting, too. I've got some of his biographies here. Here's one, Young Ludwig, is the first half of his life, and I can't wait for the other book to come out that gives the second half. And here's Ray Monks, The Duty of Genius. And it's interesting that they say that at one point, this is one of those weird little facts of history, that Wittgenstein was in high school, in the same high school about the same time that Hitler was there. And whether their paths crossed, who knows. But anyway, Wittgenstein studied mechanical engineering at Berlin, and then he went to England, where he got interested in math, and that led him into philosophy. And you see, it's interesting, too, if you think about it, that many of the great philosophers of the 20th century were mathematicians. And see, one of the things with philosophy is they're always looking for what is certain. What can you find as certainty? And the idea was that mathematics can lead to absolute certainty. I mean, you think about for a minute, 2 + 2 = 4, right? I mean, whether you're a conservative, whether you're a liberal, whether you're a Muslim, whether you're an atheist, whether you live in the, you know, whether you're traveling to, you know, to the moon, whether you're on the Pacific 2,000 years ago, 2 + 2 = 4. It's not contingent upon culture or background or so on. You know, isn't that's the basic idea? Well, in fact, that's not quite as solid as we want, but that's a whole other talk with another person I want to get into one day, a real hero of mine, that's Kurt Gödel. But that's another talk. But the point is the idea that you can find a great deal of certainty with math. Math is the idea. Now, I remember once when I was younger, as a kid, I wanted to study astronomy, and I thought, oh, I'll be great. I'll just stand up there and look up at the stars and, you know, muse about Pluto and so on. Then I started looking at these astronomy books, and it was all numbers, numbers. numbers. And yeah, you know, numbers. I'm a writer. Numbers bore me. But the idea is that you have absolute certainty with numbers, and philosophers are seeking certainty. And so that's why, as I said, many of the philosophers were into numbers. Well, anyway, Wittgenstein goes to England, where he got involved some philosopher with the great philosophers like Bertrand Russell and Moore, and they were very impressed with the guy, even though they knew he was a genius, he was kind of a weirdo. In fact, when Wittgenstein's father died and Wittgenstein got all the money, he was one of the most wealthy men in Europe. What did he do with the money? Well, he gave it all away. Well, World War I comes around and Wittgenstein joins the army, and it's why he's in the army fighting, and even as a POW, he wrote this little book that made him famous. This book is called Tractatus Logico Philosophicus. It's this tiny little book, and overnight he became famous, at least among philosophers. And it's a very difficult book to read. I mean, you could spend 6 months plowing through this thing, trying to find out exactly what it was saying. But the bottom line, Wittgenstein was trying to understand language and how language works and what can we learn from languages. You see, the funny thing is philosophers, they kind of float around looking for truth. You know, and it's kind of back and forth, and they react against each other. It's kind of dialectical. For many people, they think metaphysics is the ultimate truth. Truth is found in ultimate reality. What's really out there behind what you see? What is the earth stuff? What is the ultimate nature? And others say, nah, forget about all that metaphysical mumbo-jumbo. Reality is as it appears to us. What you see is what you get. We can only know what's in our eyes and our ears and so on. Forget all that other stuff. And other people go, nah, that's silly empirical nonsense. You can't trust your senses. I mean, if you go your senses, the earth doesn't move, you know, and the earth sits still and so on. In fact, there was a story one time with Wittgenstein where somebody was mocking the ancients. They were saying, how stupid those people to look up and think the sun is moving across the sky. And I think Wittgenstein said something to the effect of, well, how would the sun look if it were actually moving across the sky? The point is they're saying, hey, forget about the way things are. You got to go logic and reason. You can only find truth there, not all this contingent stuff. Well, other people said, nah, truth is found in the mind. Truth is what goes on in our mind. Our mind construes reality. Our mind is the only place where truth could be found. Well, then some people say, well, truth is in the mind, but German minds are different than French minds are different than Dutch minds, and so we have to take the culture into account and so on. In other words, see, they go back and forth on and on and on with the idea of where to find truth. And then with Wittgenstein and in the 20th century, the idea came up when we want to try to find truth. Truth resides in our language, in our words. Now think about that for a minute. That's not as far-fetched as it might sound. When we know something, what do we know it with? We know it with words. We think in words. We formulate idea in words. We work with language. If there were no words, there were no language, there were no grammar, there could be no truth, there could be no philosophy. So the whole idea is that to know truth, the key is to study language, and that's where we get it. In fact, there was a story of a big fight one time between Ludwig Wittgenstein and another philosopher, Karl Popper, over. In fact, somebody wrote a book about it, Wittgenstein's Poker. It wasn't that good, but it was an interesting read anyway. But they got in a big fight, and supposedly Wittgenstein threatened with the poker, because the gist of the fight was Wittgenstein is saying philosophy is all language, and Popper's saying no, it's not. But anyway, this is the point. This was the basic theme of Wittgenstein's first book, the Tractatus. It was an idea to show the limits of language. And he basically came up with what he called this picture theory of language, that language is pictures, and that's it, on and on and on. And basically, he believed he solved the whole problem of philosophy. He was done. So he quit philosophy, period, and went back to Europe and taught high school for a while. And then during World War, then he came back to England during the Second World War. And during the war, he worked as a porter. Then he went back to Cambridge and taught there a little bit and so on. That's where he lived before he died. And the funny thing is he never published another book after Tractatus. That was the last thing he ever published. And the funny thing about it, he writes this book, and the book makes him famous. Okay, and all these students are, you know, swooning over him, even though he was a kind of a weirdo. And yet, the funny thing about it is, he started having doubts. He started having doubts about what he had in the book. So the guy writes this book, makes it famous, and then he pretty much spends the rest of his life refuting the basic things that he had in the book. But you got to hand it to a guy who can do that. And it's actually the latter Wittgenstein, the Wittgenstein that refutes some of the premises in here that I want to look at. Because in both cases, again, early and later, Wittgenstein, he's still dealing with the questions of language. What are the limits of language and how language reins us in and or helps us understand reality? You know, he ended the Tractatus with this famous line, one of his most famous lines, what cannot be said must be passed over in silence. Now, what does that mean? Again, think about it for a minute. As I said, we think in words, don't we? Just in words. And I can remember many years ago, I lived in Sweden. You know, jag pratade bo I Sverige. Kan ni alla förstå mig när jag pratar svensk? Now, my point is this. I remember I was living in Sweden. And after a while, when I was there, I started to think in the language. We think in words. So if we think in words, but what do words mean? How do we define words? If I'm thinking of a word and someone says to me, you know, someone says a word to me, what does that word mean? What do I do but give him a definition? Let's take the word egregious. Okay, how would I define egregious? Well, I might define it with another word. I might say heinous, or I might say it's bad. Okay, and I could go on and on and on, but the point is I define a word with another word, and it goes on and on and on. I think of one time the writer Thomas Hardy looked up the reference to see the use of a word, and he was shocked because he saw his use of the word was the official reference for the word. So you see, we're kind of trapped by words. You know, how can we escape from words? Because we can use symbols, but we think of the symbols as words. I mean, think of E equals MC squared, that famous formula. Well, it's those, for the formula, those letters we understand as words. You see a red traffic light, you know to stop. You might not think consciously, but you know, and you think in your mind to stop. So you see, the bottom is the words are the bottom line. Language is the bottom line. I say, how do you get out behind language? How do you get out? You know, some people have come up with what they call a meta language. It's just kind of the symbolic language that used to try to get behind language. You know, so we're not using words. But again, even if you have a meta language, how do you understand what the meta language is? You understand it in words. In a sense, words are kind of like the axioms in math. They're unprovable presuppositions that you just have to take on faith. Words are kind of like the bottom line, the first principle. You see what I'm saying? How do you get behind words? You think in words, and you think, and you try to look at your thoughts, and you go behind and behind, and you're still with words in a vicious circle. See, that's all fine, except for one problem. Words are very subjective. Words are, it's like building your house, you know, made out of Jell-O. I mean, think about axioms and logic for a minute. You think about the law of excluded middle. You think of, the law of non-contradiction. I mean, these are supposedly very firm and very absolute foundations on which to build something. But to build the foundation of all our knowledge or our beliefs of everything we know on words, what a mess. You know, you think of, say, something is beautiful. I might listen, I like Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven. That's a beautiful song. I might look at, I have a dog. I think my dog is beautiful. I have my wife. I think my wife is beautiful. I love, what's his face? The crazy Dutch, Van Gogh. The ear guy, yeah. The Dutchman who cut his ear off. I love some of his paintings. And I can use the word beautiful for all of them, but what does a dog and a nice song and Van Gogh's painting have in common? And yet we use the word beautiful. I remember years ago, when I was in religious liberty work and the question of pornography, and the Supreme Court justice said, pornography, I know it when I see it. Well, that might be fine, but that hardly gives you an adequate definition of what it is. And Wittgenstein dealt with this whole question. He had his famous story about a beetle in a box. Let's say you took 10 people and they all had a box and nobody could look inside the other person's box, and they all opened the box and they all opened it and they were told to say what they see in the box. Well, they open up the box and instantly they all say beetle, 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 beetle. Everybody says beetle. Now, how is it that they all could say the same thing? It's because they just didn't happen in a vacuum. It's because these people say they were total strangers. It's only because they had a common language. There was a certain social convention which allowed them all to know that something with these characteristics that looks like this and so on would be beetle. No, there's nothing absolute about the word beetle. In another language, it could have meant empty. It could have meant Starbucks coffee. It could have meant ham and eggs. Other folks with another language looking in might have used different words for the word beetle. I don't know what the word beetle is in Italian or French, but I don't think it's beetle, and they would have said something else. But the point is the only way they could do that is because of social convention. Or, you know, Wittgenstein even thought, suppose somebody who existed, the only person in the universe, no one else. He'd look in a box and he'd see something, and he would see the same colors and everything it was, but he wouldn't have a language for it. He wouldn't have a word for it, so he wouldn't really know what it is. Wittgenstein's point is that we get our language. It's all subjective. It's all cultural. Okay? All of which leads to an interesting dilemma. In fact, it's more than a dilemma. It's an outright, you know, epistemological disaster. And the point is that if language is the foundation and the basis of everything we know, and yet this is so fluctuating and changing, you know, that's, you know, in a sense, that's terrible. All we have, said Wittgenstein, are language games and words in which words take on meanings only in the specific context in which these words are used. And the words and meanings change. So for Wittgenstein, and this is the key to latter Wittgenstein, the key was to don't look at a meaning, simply look at how a word was used. I mean, give you an example. To say that John is gay today means something radically different than the 50 years ago to say John is gay. Same word, same spelling, same everything, and yet the context, the society, the culture changed the meaning. And so Wittgenstein's basic point, it basically, is that words are not absolute. There's a fluidity and a fluctuation within them, say, compared to numbers, which doesn't allow you to find something absolute with language. And I think that's basically his whole point. With what he's saying is that words don't give us this kind of absolute foundation. So where are we here now? The most basic and fundamental things we have to know anything are words. Words. And yet words are so fluid and so subjective. And, you know, we can't get behind words. You know, kind of language sort of forms the edges of our knowledge. We can't get behind it. Because if you're going to think about what's behind them, you think about it in words and you get on and on and on. Maybe that's why what Wittgenstein meant when he had this famous line where he said, the limits of my world is the limits of my language are the limits of my world. Now, it gets even worse than this, though. It gets even worse than this. We come to these edges, not just with words, but with everything, with the fundamental elements of existence itself. Think about it. We come to an edge with something. We understand something only so far. But that means if you come to an edge, it implies the idea that there's something beyond the edge. It's just out of our reach at the time. The very idea of an edge implies a place where something stops. And if it stops, something goes beyond it. You know, think about chess for a minute. I've always wanted to play chess. I learned I'd never had the time. You know, but you think about it. Where did the pawn learn to move the way? Why does the pawn move a certain way? Why does the queen move a certain way? Why doesn't it move other ways? These things didn't arise from anything themselves. No, just like the word beetle came from something outside of the beetle, the rules of chess didn't arise from the game of chess themselves. I mean, there was nothing inherent in a pawn that says it's got to do this, and a queen that says it got to do that. The rules of chess could have had the pawn move diagonally, could have had the little horse or whatever move another way, could have had the squares shaped like circles. The point is that something outside the game of self of chess created the rules of chess. The rules of chess didn't arise from itself. I mean, pieces of wood and plastic and stone shaped like horses can't create rules for themselves. Of course not. Of course not. And this was Wittgenstein's point. Now, let's go from Wittgenstein to Goldstein. I mean, it's a few steps down, but hey, folks, you get what you pay for. We would agree, I would hope, that the rules of chess don't arise from the chess themselves, right? Of course not. That would be absurd. Now, though, let's step away from something like chess, something fairly simple as the rules of chess. Let's go to something a little more complicated. What about, for instance, the laws of gravity? You know, here, take this book, and I dropped this book. That was the law of gravity. That was the law of gravity. You know, the law of gravity. I can lift the book up, and here's it got the whole planet pulling against me, all the planet pulling against me, and I can just lift my arm up and against the law of gravity. Now, the other thing, too, is we're so used to seeing the book fall. But if I lived on a planet with zero gravity, I'd let the book go and it would just float off somewhere. So you see, there's nothing inherent in the book which says the book would have to fall. Just like there's nothing inherent in a chessboard which says the pawn has to do this and the queen has to do that. It's just that these rules of chess, just as the rules of chess didn't arise from anything on the chessboard, the rules of this book falling don't arise from anything in the book. It comes because of gravity. Well, to say that it's gravity does that only pushes the problem back a little bit. Where do the laws of gravity come from? Why is it that every object in the universe pulls on every object? Yeah, right now I'm exerting a gravitational pull on Pluto, and Pluto's pulling the pull on me. Is exerting a pull on me. But why do they do it that way? And they do it to exact measurable formula as well. You can measure the formula. But maybe they should repel each other. Maybe the formula could have been different. Why is it exactly one way and not the other? Again, it's for the same reason. Why does a pawn move one way and not another? Why does gravity move one way and on another? Because something outside made it do that. You know, Einstein showed how gravity works. He showed how matter bends space and times. That's general relativity. Einstein got it down to a formula, to math. It's very complicated math, but it works. But again, I asked the same question. Why does matter bend space and time and doing according to a certain formula? Could those formulas have differed? Could matter have acted differently on space and time? There's got to be a reason. Just there's the reason that the pawn moves one way and not another, you know, on the chessboard. And that reason, the reason will be outside of matter, space, and time, just as the reason the pawn moved a certain way was outside of the pawn. Why do space and time and matter act as they do? Because something outside them made them act that way. And you see, we can keep going back. We can keep going back till we reach an edge. See, science could take us to an edge. Our physics could take us to a point. And they say, okay, here's where we are now. This is why this does this and not that. And then we don't know why. And then maybe somebody comes along and says, okay, now we know. Now we know it. That's got to be the reason for it. But then we're at another edge. Can you see that? And see, and just as Einstein took us beyond Newton, sooner or later, some scientists will go beyond Einstein, beyond the edge where he had us. And then someone could go beyond the edge that person had to create a new edge. In other words, we do this, gravity works, and you know, matter bends space and time for this reason. Okay, but then someone says, well, why does it do that? He says, well, it does it, you know, maybe 50 years later for that reason. And then someone takes them to a new edge, and they go on and on and on, and there's no... You go on and on and on, and ultimately, do you go on and on forever, or do you come to an edge? See, if you say you go on and on forever, you run into a real problem. It's called traversing the infinite, and I don't want to get into that now. That's a whole other talk. But if you don't go on and on and on, so you come to an edge. You come to an edge. Well, gravity does this because of such and such. Okay, well, why? Well, because it does because of such and such. And it does because of such and such. Sooner or later, either it goes on forever, which again, I say is very difficult, or what? Or maybe that there's a God, a creator, someone who exists outside the rules of science, who is beyond and greater than the rules and laws of physics, the one who is to us... To the rules of physics as those who are created the game of chess, word of the pieces of chess. Can you see the point? See, sooner or later you come to an edge, and then at one point you gotta stop. It's gotta stop. And where else could it stop but at God? Now please, I don't want to be dogmatic about this. I mean, please, to be dogmatic about what's beyond the edge when I don't even know what edge we're at. I don't know how many more edges we are. Einstein's taken us this far. There might be 20 more edges before we get to the end. So how can I be dogmatic about that? I can't. But I just can't help but think, just as language brings us to a point, and we know it stops, even though we know there's more beyond it. And we get to the real world, and we get one scientific explanation. And that explains it. But then, you know, there's another explanation after that. And another explanation after that. And another that somewhere, sooner or later, it's all got to stop. That somewhere there's an ultimate explanation for this. Just as the rules of chess didn't rise from chess. That these rules that govern the universe, that govern time, matter, energy, space, and matter, all these things didn't arise from themselves, but something greater than all these things. And what else could that be? What else could that be other than God, the God of the Bible, that's the God that's depicted in the Bible as the Creator? Can you see the point? We always come to an edge. Something explains it, and then we stop, and then we get an explanation. Fine, whatever that explanation is, then we get another explanation. These are the edges. Wittgenstein took us to the edges with language, but he knows that language isn't the end. There's more out there than words, even though we can't get past the words. And then we've got these things that science take us so far, and then we stop. And yet we know there's more. We know there's more, even though we can't quite get it. And logically, it would tell me that something stands out there above and beyond all that. And again, simple logic would tell me what else could that be but a creator God, a God who stands above all these things. That's what I got out of Wittgenstein. And though that wasn't what he was thinking, I think he was smart enough to see the implications of his thought.